Welcome. I'm Julia Child. You know, when I'm having people for dinner, I just hate not to be with them practically all the time. And that's one reason for having tabletop cookery. And so I've planned what I consider a really nifty dinner.
Hey, y'all, I'm Paula Deen. And you know, us Southern girls, we just love us a picnic.
Hey, folks, sit down. It's going to be a big night tonight because real men are making real food tonight on Emerald Live.
Americans have watched someone chop, sauté, fillet, whisk, and pour on the small screen since the earliest days of television. Today, however, with an increasingly popular 24-hour food network and a new hit reality cooking special every month, we're led to ask, why do so many of these shows endure? What is it about watching others cook that viewers find so captivating? Kathleen Collins addresses those questions and more in her new book called Watching What We Eat, The Evolution of Television Cooking Shows. It's published by Continuum. I'm very pleased to welcome Ms. Collins to our show today. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
The earliest cooking shows from the 40s and 50s seem to be hosted by what we'd now call demanding home ec teachers. Is that unfair?
Demanding. No, I don't think so. I think it's pretty accurate. I call them mental hygienic.
And did they grow out of the whole hygienic movement?
Well, they actually grew out of what was on the radio. The cooking shows on television, their progenitors were the cooking shows on radio. So those were, by and large, nutritionists, home economists, ladies giving homemaking tips.
And who were there in their audience? Generally, housewives who were looking to improve their home skills?
Sure. That was the audience. But remember, when they started on television in the 40s, people didn't really have TVs in their homes. So the audience was kind of missed. And those televisions that were in the United States at the time appeared out in public and very commonly in bars.
How many of those shows were also tied to corporate sponsors? Because I remember, even while doing this show, having one of those guests who just kept on plugging a certain appliance manufacturer. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, you can use, you don't only have to use KitchenAid Jeff. You can also use Cuisinart, can't you? In fact, there are any number of others. He said, no, only KitchenAid. And I had to say, well, is that because KitchenAid is underwriting your show?
That I think they were all tied to sponsors. That's how they came about. That was their real purpose. Their real purpose was not teaching housewives how to cook and keep their home better. It was to sell products, and it's still television's MO. But they did it very, very blatantly, and the product would be shilled throughout the episode in no uncertain terms.
Was that true of James Beard? He was one of the early ones, the pioneers. We think of him today mostly as connected to the James Beard Foundation.
Right.
But he had a show called I Love to Eat.
I Love to Eat, which was sponsored by the Borden LC the Cow Company. And he was actually criticized by some at the time for shilling so shamelessly for so many products, but he had no problem with it. And he actually was the first nationally televised cooking show. So his audience was those men in bars.
On NBC.
Mm-hmm.
But do any of those shows survive?
No, I think they were shot live. They never survived.
And you're right that his personality didn't translate so well to TV.
Right. He supposedly had a wonderful, I'm sure many people still to this day attest to his charming, outgoing personality. But apparently it just didn't work well on television.
People will remember Dion Lucas.
Right.
And that show lasted a decade.
It did. It lasted a decade, but a lot of people have not heard of her. I think she was eclipsed by Julia Child, and she didn't quite come along at the right time to last in the popular imagination. She was popular during her day. She was cooking French food, which was becoming very popular, and she was very interested in teaching housewives that you could express yourself through cooking, and cooking was an art.
So how was she much different from Julia Child? Was it just a matter of personality?
It was definitely a matter of personality. I think she had a very dry, witty, subtle personality, but she came across, as I describe in the book, in sort of a science teacherly way. She talk about demanding. I mean, she was very crisp, and she gave very exacting recipe instructions and didn't drop things and chuckle about them.
Well, but the populist thing was there from the early days as well, because I remember the I Hate to Cook show.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't remember the show. I remember the book, the Peg Bracken I Hate to Cook book in the 60s. Is that what you're referring to? Yeah, I mean, that was, I think it was a rejoinder to the joy of cooking. And it came about in the 60s when, you know, women were getting the, how dare they get the idea that they weren't just there to feed their families. And I think it's a very funny book. And useful, too. Actually has good recipes in it.
But in the case of Julia, she set the standard for everything that followed.
Definitely. Definitely.
Why? Because she was so appealing as a person?
I think it was all about her personality and the populism and her bringing French food down a notch to where people could actually master the art, as Julie Powell did and many other people did through those very explicit recipes. And her personality and the popularity of her show let people, producers, understand, oh, we can make these shows fun. Let's do more of this.
And we saw the imperfections. Mm-hmm. Saturday Night Live made fun of those imperfections, but we don't see that sort of thing anymore.
We do not see it anymore. They're edited out. They have lots of cameras filming. At the same time, they're very highly produced. That's just not, the show was shot live. You know, I mean, it was taped live. They did not edit. So,
well, and since it was popular, you'd think that they would do something like that today.
You would think so. We may see more of it because we're seeing more cooking instruction videos that people are doing their own sort of homegrown videos on the internet. And certainly those are very informal. Maybe it will become a bit of a backlash and we'll have to bring some of that more natural demeanor on television.
Did she open the door? Suddenly we had all these other people, Graham Kerr, we had Jeff Smith.
Right. Well, Graham Kerr actually started his television show in New Zealand and Australia before her. So he was already making some waves, but he came to the U.S. in 1969. So we sort of see him riding on her coattails, but they were contemporaries.
And he began each show by jumping over a tall kitchen chair while holding a full glass of wine.
Yeah, that pretty much sums him up.
What do you think made his show so popular for the time? Because was it a scandal that kind of ended him?
No, it was not a scandal.
Oh, that was
ended
Jeff
him.
Smith.
That was Jeff Smith, right. Graham Kerr was, again, all about personality. The difference between him and Julia Child was that he and his producer wife, Trina, capitalized on the idea of entertainment, whereas Julia was just entertaining because that's who she was. So they made a big point of being funny, doing funny little gags. Trina would actually do things like wall off a cupboard where he was supposed to find an ingredient and let him figure it out, you know, while they were taping to make it seem like a natural, humorous thing. And so that was really the first show that capitalized on the entertainment aspect of cooking shows.
My guest is Kathleen Collins. Her book, Watching What We Eat, The Evolution of Television Cooking Shows, published by Continuum. Well, what was the ultimate goal here? To get people to cook? Did they cook the recipes? Today, at the end of every show, they give you a website that you can go to, but they didn't have websites. Often they published a cookbook as a companion, but I'm sure many people didn't buy the cookbook.
Mm-hmm. I think everything about television has always been about selling products. So that was the main goal for the producers to get advertisers and the corporate sponsors to get customers. And then the side purpose would be certainly to teach people to cook and to entertain people more and more.
How did you wind up writing this book? Your past books have nothing to do with food or with watching television.
Well, they
do have to do with the popular culture.
Well, right. I haven't actually written books, but I've written articles and things about popular culture. But I've always been very interested in media history, television history. So it was really my foundation for thinking about what I wanted to do as a book. And then thinking about, well, what aspect of television I thought, what am I most interested in? And it was food.
Well, for a long time, the cooking shows were on public television. Mm-hmm. And then along comes cable. Mm-hmm. And that changes everything.
Mm-hmm. Right, definitely. I mean, we had some tumbleweeds there for a few years. We had the PBS was very active in producing cooking shows for a few decades. Then in 1993, the launch of the Food Network just opened up everything.
But it's very different from the original Food Network,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What was their original goal?
Well, same thing. They wanted to get a popular topic that would grab a lot of advertising dollars and a lot of eyeballs for those advertisers. So the early the executives that went from the Providence Journal Company were the people who started the Food Network. And the way they did that was to go out and actually scour magazine stands and say, what topic is so popular that isn't being addressed in broadcasting?
But and the early shows were kind of like the PBS shows, and
then
they discovered their own personalities.
Right, they were at the risk of disparaging my beloved PBS. They were a little dry, the early shows. They were not anywhere like the glitzy kind of sexy shows that we see today.
The major character here, Emeril Lagasse?
Right. He was the first hit for the Food Network, and he actually was on the Food Network from the beginning with a show called How to Boil Water, which didn't really suit him very well. For whatever reason, his natural personality and charm didn't come out in that show. But it was when Emeril Live, which I believe was 1997, really set the tone for what we see today on the Food Network with the personality, the chef personality centric.
And you quote James Poniewozik as saying, easy name for you to say, Emeril's audience wants to scream its way onto national television to hear him yell bam and kick it up a notch, and the results can be plain embarrassing. Still, in a genre once dominated by prissy Francophiles preaching to elites between pledge drives, Emeril is probably the most effective evangelist for serious cooking America's ever had.
He sums it up, doesn't he?
You agree?
Yes, I think I do agree for the most part.
And he appealed to people who might not have watched cooking shows
Definitely. Otherwise. I mean, men, young men, all kinds of people. And people loved his personality, still love him.
What about the people who complain that the Food Network and some of these other shows that have popped up on other, mostly on cable channels, aren't really for people who are serious about cooking, that they're all about spectacle?
Well, interestingly, many of the people that I spoke to, that I interviewed for the book, I expected them to say that, to complain about that and say, this is garbage, it shouldn't be on the air. But they actually say it's all for the good. It brings people in who wouldn't normally be interested and teaches people about food, whether they cook or not. It's a good thing.
Well, how many viewers do you think begin by watching Rachel Ray and then end up subscribing to Cooks Illustrated and becoming serious cooks?
Well, I can't give you numbers, but I can tell you that that is exactly what Chris Kimball, the host of America's Test Kitchen, thinks is happening. He's all for Rachel Ray as the gateway chef. Let her bring the viewers in and then move them on over. When they get really interested in cooking, come on over to PBS and look at our show.
Well, I have to apologize. The listeners, don't forget the Frugal Gourmet. Actually, we've been talking about the Frugal Gourmet. Right. We just didn't call it by that name. That was Jeff Smith.
Jeff Smith, right, the one who did unfortunately have a sad ending to his career. But he was extremely popular.
There was a sex scandal that got him thrown off.
Yeah, yeah.
You write, what's portrayed in these shows as populist as they claim to be is still an elite world where having good knives in your kitchen is a basic assumption and eating fresh, local, and at home is the ideal. But you also write a lot about how the Food Network works hard to democratize its shows by repeating anyone can do this at home.
Mm-hmm.
Do they really mean that?
It's a conundrum. I don't know. I think that is definitely their ostensible purpose is to bring people in to the kitchen and show that this is an endeavor that anybody can do. But what we actually see in those kitchens, not only the fancy kind of products and appliances and beautiful granite countertops, but the way that a 30-minute meal happens in a kitchen on TV isn't exactly how it would happen in our kitchen.
What about the fad aspect? Emeril Lagasse was the king of food TV, and now he's off of the Food Network and working for Martha Stewart. Do they have a span and then move on?
Well, I think like anybody in the limelight, the public can perhaps only take so much of a personality. I don't know if that was the case with Emeril. I mean, his contract was up, and perhaps there were many decisions that went into his move to Martha Stewart, and he has a show on Discovery now, Emeril Green. But Sarah Moulton, same thing. She lasted about the same time, about a decade at the Food Network. For whatever reason, people just decide to move on, and I'm sure the Food Network is happy for the evolution.
And now we're seeing more shows that are kind of like the other reality TV shows, mm-hmm. like Top Chef.
Right.
There's a whole bunch of those shows.
Right. They replicate like rabbits.
Do you wonder about how long they can survive?
I do wonder. I mean, personally, I can only take so much of them. I get bored. I feel like even though they're supposed to be reality shows and trying to show, anything can happen, they seem almost predictable to me now. It seems like there's just too much of it.
You know somebody who is the leading candidate is going to screw up. Right. It's not all that different from American Idol. Oh, you chose the wrong song this week.
Right. You're just waiting for that terrible thing to happen.
And then there's that added problem. We're not eating the food. We can't taste the food, so we really, at the end of Iron Chef, I look at all those dishes and they say, yum, or this is missing something. I have no idea what that's all about.
I know. It's a leap of faith. You have to wonder.
So I've wondered why so many people make that leap of faith.
Well, they just like to imagine it. I mean, that's what so much of cooking television is about, the fantasy. So what goes into it is one thing, but what comes out of it is totally up to you.
Well, Julia Child is on the cover of this book, Kathleen Collins's Watching What We Eat, The Evolution of Television Cooking Shows. It's published by Continuum. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.